Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 29, Episode 19. Coming up on this show, we've got aviation abductions, sweater melting time anomalies, and the man who exercised the Bermuda Triangle. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Well, the entirety of the Bermuda Triangle, yeah, just exercised it.
You know this story.
What's the story?
I spoke about the guy back in 2020. His name is Kenneth McCall, and he was on a cruise, I think in his elderly years. He was on a cruise with his wife going through, you know, Bermuda.
Yeah.
Right? He's on some Jamaican cruise. And there was a huge storm that encompassed their ship, and one of the boilers broke, and they were just basically astray. They were just drifting. And during the silence on the sea, he said he and his wife heard this, it was like a strange moaning on the wind, like some kind of sad song, like a sad chant. It almost
like
sounded like singing of sorts. And at first they thought it was the crew, like the Jamaican crew were down below singing or something. So he went and confronted them, and they said, "It's not us, we're not making the sound." And yeah, he and his wife were just, it went on for like 2 days. They heard this, you know, really haunting kind of sound on the wind. And eventually they got the engine started again, and they, you know, made it back to their destination. And days later, he found this article detailing the slave ships that used to sail through there.
Mm-hmm.
And in this article, it was, you know, going through the designs of the ships and everything, but it also mentioned that it was something like 2 million slaves ended up getting thrown overboard in this area that they had sailed through.
Oh, I have, yeah, heard something.
You remember this story?
Because those ships were horrific as well. I think the distance between the decks was only like 4 feet or something, so there was a lot of trauma and terror, all things that lead to hauntings.
Yeah, pack them in like sardines, but often they would be thrown overboard because they would be deemed unworthy for sale. So if you can't, you know, if you don't think they're healthy enough, they're not going to get what it's worth to transport them.
Oh, it's barbaric.
They would throw them over, and they would do that for the sick and the infirm. And so, yeah, that was the figure that this article had, like 2 million slaves thrown overboard. And he realized what he was hearing were essentially, from his perspective, because this guy was a Christian missionary, He believed that these souls were stuck in a kind of purgatory in the Bermuda Triangle. And that's why so many ships and planes had been disappearing for so many years, because of these spirits. He claims it's because of spirits. So he went back to England, and he got a bishop and another priest and these exorcists from different churches, and they chartered a boat. And they went out there and did an exorcism of the Bermuda Triangle. And that's why, ever since he did this in like 1977, we haven't had any major disappearances since 1977. He took care of it.
Now that I think of it, I don't think there has been any significant disappearances in the last, you know, 30, 40 years.
It hasn't. Like, think about all the Bermuda Triangle stories. They're all from the 1960s and 70s and earlier.
I will potentially contradict you, because I am going to go into some strange time anomalies which might have a connection to the Bermuda Triangle, but it may not be the Bermuda Triangle. It could just be a natural phenomenon that occurs all around the globe. So it's not just that particular location. So it might be a completely separate kind of thing, but we're going to get into that. But with this guy performing the exorcism, and now that everything's cleared up, what are you to go into? Is there a follow-up to
it? Well, he came up, remember on the last episode, we were talking about Padre Pio, because we discovered that the late exorcist of the Vatican, Father Amorth, had written a book about Padre Pio.
And their friendship.
And they were close friends, and he was his spiritual mentor. And I was going through, and I forgot to mention that Father Amorth, when he did exorcisms for the Vatican, for the church, years after Padre Pio's death, he said on more than one occasion, the possessed target, the possessed person he was trying to help, the entity that was speaking through them would suddenly say something like, "Ah, that priest is here." And he'd be like, "Yeah, I'm here." And the demon would say, "Not you, the other one." And there'd be no one else in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually he'd get out of the demonic entity that Padre Pio was there, and the demon was terrified. So Padre Pio was basically showing up after his death, assisting with Father Amorth's exorcisms, according to Father Amorth.
Yeah, it's like he became a guardian.
And so I was going through this book he has on the antics of Satan and his army of fallen angels from Father Amorth. And he mentions McCall, this Kenneth McCall, and his work with ancestral memories. And that of course, was tied into
strongly linking to that
his Bermuda Triangle story. Now, the amazing thing about Kenneth McCall is that he was basically trapped in China during World War II. He was born in China. He's an Englishman, but he was born in China. His parents were missionaries. He became a missionary. And he went back there in 1937 in the middle of guerrilla warfare between the communists and the nationalists and the Japanese army and just tried to help people. He set up hospitals and tried to help the sick and the wounded. And he has incredible stories, which we haven't covered before, from those early years of going through China and being assisted and saved by strange robed entities in white and invisible beings and all sorts of weird stuff. So I'm going to be going through his travels in 1930s China and what he discovered.
Okay, I'm looking forward to getting into that. I'm going to go on this particular show. I was looking into this for the Plus show earlier in the week, and I ended up kind of expanding this out into a much bigger story because I was reading excerpts of the new book, Eject, Eject. It's not out yet. It hasn't been fully published. There's only excerpts available. It's been written by John Nicol, and John Nicol is a really fascinating guy. He was in a tornado jet. He was a RAF navigator when he was blasted out of the cockpit by an ejection seat because he was shot down over Iraq.
We mentioned this on the last show. You didn't have time to go into it. This was the ejection seat conspiracy, right?
That's right. Well, the ejection seat conspiracy links into the disappearance of another pilot many decades before. But before I get into that and start talking about the ufological aspects of it, because funnily enough, this is a highly, highly controversial case. Like even amongst UFO researchers, the children of the pilot that disappeared, pro-government people, anti-government people. Look, the one thing that I'll say out of this, if anything, you know, we've learned in the last 3 years is that governments are completely untrustworthy. Like you cannot trust them. And it turns out that it might be something very simple that they were just trying to cover up incompetence.
Okay.
Or it could be a massive extraterrestrial conspiracy, depending on which direction you want to go.
Despite what the evidence says, let's go with the latter.
Well, I'm just going to leave it open for you to interpret it whatever way you want. And I'm also going to offer an alternative, that there might be some type of natural phenomenon going on here. Because, you know, there's stories out there like the Frederick Valentich case, you know, which is very well known. It was that young pilot who was flying from the state of Victoria. He was flying down to King Island over the Bass Strait. This is back in 1978. He was flying in a small single-engine aircraft. And the reason why this story stands out is because he just disappeared. He just disappeared from the face of the globe. But when he did so, there was strange anomalies that were reported. There were people saying around the time that they had seen some type of UFO activity. When he was reporting back to air traffic controllers, ground radar, they noticed that there was something strange going on with his aircraft. There was a description of a strange scratching metal kind of noise that was heard over the radio. And so the idea is with the Valentich case, and this is where a lot of people tend to lean towards, is that the guy was abducted in the air by aliens or extraterrestrials.
But he heard a strange noise. He reported hearing a very strange noise and seeing something before he disappeared.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So that in itself became this controversial case in Australia, but apparently it's happened many times before. You know, you expect when it comes down to extraterrestrials, you hear many stories of people being taken from their cars, being taken from their bedrooms, even occasionally being taken from shopping centres, that kind of thing. But to actually hear stories of people being taken from aircraft, while you might think that it's rare, and it is, there are more cases than I think you'd expect. And it comes back to this case that was described by John Nicol in his new book, Eject, Eject. Although John very much goes down the path of, well, this is a government cover-up due to ineptitude, but I think it's something else. But let's get into it. Before we get into his story, though, about this missing pilot, I want to talk about the actual history of the ejector seat itself, because I think that this is something we all see in movies, we know it from popular culture, and we just kind of take it for granted that, oh, yeah, you know, pilots are able to just eject out of a plane, then, you know, they'll be fine.
It's just a big spring, like in the cartoons,
it's
right?
It's nothing like that. It's an extremely sophisticated technology. And when John Nicol had to evacuate from his aircraft, he had to do it manually. Like, he had to pull the ejection, you know, there's like a handle kind of double handle you got to pull down on, and it throws the canopy off and then it ejects you out in this dual stage kind of explosive event. But to actually get to that point, and that happens in 2.5 seconds, this is back in the first Gulf War in 1991. Today, computers do it all for you. It's all computer guided, and it happens in 1.5 seconds.
Yeah, you were saying the early models, it was like a 30-second release time.
30 seconds it takes you to get out of these things.
Like, imagine you could pull it and then somehow get out of the crash and then be like, oh, crap, it's just going to go off.
Well, the thing is, like, when aircraft were obviously in their early days of development, certainly fighter aircraft were in their early days of development, it was fine when you, well, I shouldn't say it was fine, but it was easier when you were in propeller-driven aircraft. But when it started moving into the jet age, then you're moving at such speeds that you don't have 30 seconds to think, well, how am I going to get out? Apparently back then, the way that they worked, they were very rudimentary, that you'd be fired out. But when you were fired out, you'd then have to somehow unstrap yourself from the seat that was still attached to you and then make sure you don't unstrap your parachute. And then you're thinking about this. This is all going through your mind as your aircraft is spiraling into the ground. You know, it's a crazy kind of thing. But where it got there, it all started back in the early 1940s and kind of moved through. So in 1944, the military approached James Martin to see if he could assist in developing an ejection seat. And he came up with some really intriguing ideas about how you could do this. But guess what? He didn't know anything about the biomechanics that would be involved, the amount of G-forces that could be applied to a human being. They had very kind of rudimentary test systems on the ground. So people would...
They strapped a monkey or a pig.
Well, kind of. There's no depiction of that in Nicole's book as far as what I've read, but I wonder if that's exactly what probably happened. I mean, they did sandbags. They were, you know, basically building this large ladder-like structure with a seat attached to it with explosive material underneath. And they would fire up like 40-pound bags of sand to see what happen. But there was also a test pilot by the name of John Lancaster. He was known as Joe. And he was experimented with as a test pilot in one of these ejection seats on the ground. And I think he said something along the lines of, it rather hurt his backside.
Yeah, you can imagine.
Well, of course I can imagine. And what they found out quite rapidly with the development of these early versions of the ejector seat was that it's not actually the G-forces. The human body can tolerate, you know, 4, 5, 6 Gs, but it's not about the number of Gs that you're really approaching. It's how far they're applied.
Oh, I see.
So if they're applied almost instantaneously or extremely rapidly, which it would be with an explosive event, that's what can kill you. Mm. And a whole heap of early test pilots, they had shattered vertebrae and you know, major injuries that came about from just testing this stuff. And so they realized that they could develop a dual explosive system. So essentially you have a little explosion that knocks you up, and then you have a secondary explosion, which then starts accelerating you to, I think it's like 60 meters a second or something in that range.
And it's on some gradual curve instead
exactly.
of an immediate
rather than this
torque.
Immediate force, which could possibly knock you unconscious, which you still need to, you know, keep your wits about you. And if you're traveling at this extreme speed, you need to have as much ability to maintain, you know, your surroundings or an understanding of your surroundings. So with Joe, he was just like, oh, this is too painful. I'm never going to need to use one of these things. But the military back at that time, they were losing pilots left, right, and center. In fact, in 1949, I believe they lost, or in somewhere in that range, they lost 24 British test pilots. Because even the famous Geoffrey de Havilland Jr. was put in a prototype jet that did a high-speed dive, and it smashed into the Thames estuary because there was like these spars that supported the wings. They just cracked and disintegrated as it got to a certain speed. And he was found on the mudflats, his neck broken. He was equipped with a parachute, but he wasn't able to get out. There wasn't enough time to get out. So with the military losing these skilled people, because it takes time to train people to fly aircraft, but it was in the day and age where we didn't have computer-aided design. We didn't have the commonplace use of wind tunnels. So he had people like test pilot Joe Lancaster, who would have to get into the air, into these test aircraft, and see exactly what they could do. And on May the 30th in 1949, that's exactly what he did. He took to the air in an experimental or prototype aircraft. Things were going seemingly okay until he got himself into a little bit of trouble. He climbed to about 5,000 feet. He started doing this shallow dive. And as he was doing, there was nothing. It's nothing that really an aircraft shouldn't be able to handle. But suddenly the plane starts bucking like a roller coaster. He's being hurled around in his seat. He's trying to throttle back. The aircraft stops responding. And of course, it's out of control. So he's like, what am I going to do? It's dropping fast. The aircraft is spinning. He's sure that at any second he's going to die. And then he knows that he's sitting on a new contraption, one that he was initially extremely suspicious about. But now he knows that that's his only means of survival. And as the Earth is careening up to meet him, he's only got moments to get out. So he grabs hold of these handles and pulls the handle and is projected. The canopy comes flying off and he's projected out of this aircraft and he survives. But, well, he almost didn't survive because once he was projected out and he's looking around, he's still conscious, he's looking around, he's managed to unbuckle himself, fortunately, from the seat, not from his parachute. But he's like, oh, crap, where's the seat? And he looks around, and as he spins around, the seat goes, whoom.
Oh, nearly crushed him.
Yeah. So this is another danger that's attached to these things. I mean, how wild and crazy is this? These guys really were pioneers. Like, we do take things so much for granted today with what we have with computer-aided design and you know, modeling that we can use.
Why was he suspicious of the seat? He just didn't
He was one of the early test pilots on the ground.
Right.
He was the guy that was like, it hurt my backside. And that was him being polite. He's like, it wasn't that. It was horrendous.
But it saved his life.
Yeah, it did save his life. So you've got James Martin, who was the developer. You know, he actually was friends with the pilot. And sadly, this pilot, his name was Valentin Baker. He crashed his aircraft and unfortunately he was incinerated. So this inspired Martin to think about a way that he could come up with a prototype escape system that would be effective in saving these pilots, saving their lives. And we really have gotten to that point. You know, as I was saying earlier, you know, we're talking about Nicole himself, 1991, 2.5 seconds to get out. Now with the computer-aided systems, it's 1.5 seconds, it's done. And these things, ejector seats, I didn't realize that there were actually records kept about this. But apparently, Nicole himself, he was ejectee 6,089. Up until the last few weeks, so when this particular article was published, we now have 7,681 aviators who have survived as a result of ejection seats.
That's pretty regular.
That's a lot of people in this day. Like, think about how long aviation, this kind of aviation, has been going for. It's only been really the last 60 years that this has saved a lot of lives.
But in the newer systems, is it still manual? Do you still have to pull something?
No, I think you can, but in the new systems, essentially the computer decides, nope, you're in trouble, you're going to get out, and it will dump you out. And then, of course, you know, we'll throw off the canopy and you don't have to worry about the seat flying past you because it's connected to the seat and very sophisticated, modern kind of design. And it's really cool. Like, it's really cool to think that, yeah, it would make sense that all of this technology and development and decades of experience have gone into this life-saving device. But that's not the reason why I wanted to describe this story to you. It's actually because when I was going through John Nicol's work, one of the later chapters in his book, Eject, Eject, of course, was I'll link to the pre-order in the show notes so you can pick it up, actually relates to a highly controversial story about the disappearance of US pilot Captain Bill Schaffner. This guy was on secondment. He was with the ranks of the 5th Squadron over in the UK. He was at RAF Binbrook. This is in Lincolnshire. And he was learning to fly these one-man Lightning fighter planes. It was part of an exchange program, essentially. He'd gone over there with his wife and his small children, David, Glenn, and baby Michael. And this was the Cold War. You know, it's September the 8th, 1970, and on this base, even though he was there for training purposes, all personnel at this particular base were required to be fully prepared for a threat that was coming in from the Soviets. And now this is the official story. This is where we're up to at the moment. The official story is that a major exercise was being conducted to test the squadron's reaction to a Soviet attack on the UK. And the official story is that the pilot, Captain Bill Schaffner, got into one of these aircraft. He was told that he had to be deployed. Now, what's really important to note here is that the weather was crazy. It was just intense, wild weather that was coming in. They were still conducting this exercise. He was scrambled. He took off in his fighter, an XS-894. It was just, you know, chaos for him. And he was given the call sign Charlie 45. Now, he climbed to 10,000 feet over the North Sea. About 3 minutes, 5 seconds later, he was logged at a radar station at Partington in Yorkshire. The exercise was going well. And he was supposed to shadow these Avro Shackleton craft, but they were actually posing as Soviet bombers that were heading towards the Yorkshire coast. And he was doing this. He was shadowing it. He was given orders that he had to then potentially shepherd them if they came and turned around. It's getting dark. He's only got 18 hours of night flying on this particular aircraft. It's all very strange.
It's funny. If you Google that aircraft, the very top first result
is Schaffner,
is what you're describing.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's what is strange about this is that the official story doesn't make any sense. So the official story is that as the night became pitch black, the weather worsened, it got far worse than what I was describing before. He was then sent orders, because he could no longer apparently see the horizon. He was sent orders, even with this limited experience, his workload in the cockpit being, you know, at breaking point, he's then told that his mission has been upgraded and he has to intercept another false aircraft, one that they said was heading towards the coast. And so he does. He has to head in and shadow this aircraft. It's only 12 minutes after he had taken off when he's flying along the UK coastline, trying to get hold of this aircraft, which is being used in the exercise. His radio response goes dead. He's gone. And they can't find him. He doesn't show up on radar. No one knows what's going on. Now, he was supposed to be back very soon. He doesn't respond. They start looking for him. They send aircraft to go and see if he's crashed into the ocean. They can't find him. There's just nothing. A lifeboat and the RAF Marine branch sent a rescue vessel out to go and see what is in the area. They're peeling their eyes in the darkness for something floating in the sea. Obviously, being a pilot, he would be in one of those survival suits, so he'd have a survival beacon on him, which would allow him to signal rescuers. These details are actually very important, because if he had crashed and if he had been wearing a survival suit, it's highly unlikely that the beacon that he was carrying would have been flung off from him. That just seems to be kind of strange. Like, if he survived the crash, he should have been able to set this radar off. Or not the radar, but the radio, I'm sorry, off. Nothing seems to happen. Now, a week later, there's no signs of him. Or his lightning. Like, no one knows what happened to him. And everyone just presumes that he's dead. His wife and children head back to the US. And for whatever reason, his wife, Linda, just had this nagging, understandable, nagging thing that just kept on coming into her mind. Like, what happened to him? Did he? Of course, obviously, she would be thinking what happened to him. But it was also, where's his body? Mm. Where's the plane? Like, there must be some type of hope.
And I found at the UK National Archives, they've got everything online, mm-hmm. and there's the Ministry of Defence section, and I found this case, and it's closed for 90 years.
Yeah, I'm so pleased you said that.
You can't. It's going to be opened on the 1st of January 2085.
Why?
Exactly.
Why would you do that? It's just, there's
something. It's just some training exercise. What was he actually chasing?
Okay. So a month later, a Royal Navy minesweeper in the North Sea picked up some bulky object on its sonar. This was about 5 miles off Flamborough Head, and it was lying in the mud on the seabed about 100 feet from the surface. So a diver went down and reported back. It was Schaffner's lightning. It had broken its back, but apart from that, it was remarkably undamaged. Remarkably. Now, they sent down Navy divers to go and see what they could find and attempt to recover the aircraft. The cockpit was closed. Right, the cockpit was closed, but it was empty.
What?
There was no sign of the pilot. Now, this is important to note. There is no other way of getting out of this aircraft. There was no holes in the side. As I said, his back was broken. But apart from that, it suggests that what he had to do was somehow open it, climb out of the aircraft, and then reclose
it. And then close it.
And then allow it to sink.
Or something else closed it. Now, someone else closed it.
Exactly. So the next thing about this is that the ejection seat was still in the aircraft. The harness, yeah. So he didn't eject out. And if he had ejected out, the canopy would have flown off. So this is a strange mystery. So later, a board of inquiry was set up to look into the accident. And they ran into a whole host of difficult questions. Why had the pilot not pulled the handle? What had happened to him? Had he managed to unstrap himself and climb out? But still, why was the canopy closed?
And did he ditch it in the ocean? Because his ejector seat failed. Ditch it in the ocean. The plane was, not completely submerged. He had time to open the cockpit, get out and close it. And then he just drowned.
That's a possible. That's the official story.
Right.
That's,
I'm just going with the logical conclusion.
Yeah. John Nicol is, that's where he is at the moment. He's like, basically what happened is the aircraft in almost complete blackness, in rough seas, extremely rough seas, it smacks into the water. It floats for some time. He's still conscious. He manages to open it, climb out, and then float away. And then as the aircraft sank, then the canopy just somehow miraculously closes shut.
So he could have, it depends on the canopy, I guess. Is it electronically controlled? Most of those old planes, it's manual.
It is manual, but they were saying that it was the hydraulics of the water, the hydraulic effect of the water is what forced it closed.
It just snapped it back shut.
Yeah, but it goes backwards. So it was pushed forward. So as it's sinking down into the water.
What do you mean it goes backwards?
Okay, so the canopy, right? You pull the canopy backwards. Right? But it was sinking down in the water nose first. So why would the hydraulic pressure cause it to push for the canopy to push forward?
Do we know it was sinking nose first?
That is the speculation that is out there. And there's a number of people, and this is what I was saying before, why this is a highly controversial case. Look, I'll give you the summary of what Nicole thinks happens. He says that what's occurred here is that essentially, because he took off so fast, like he had to, you know, be deployed so rapidly, apparently he sent away his support crew. He said, no, it doesn't need servicing. I'm just going to go. He took off without any servicing. And it just so happens that there was a servicing error. The tiniest detail, a damaged singular screw thread, meant that the canopy jettison unit failed to fire. If it had been serviced correctly, he may still be alive today. This is a report. This is what was put forward by the Board of Inquiry, right?
But if he had actually ejected, wouldn't he just have ended up in the sea anyway?
Oh, yes, he would have. Yeah, that's true. But then why was he not found by his locator beacon, his radio?
Mm.
Why would you not find that? And apparently, you know, because of the survival suit he was wearing, when he was in the ocean, he would have been able to survive at least from the exposure for 30 minutes, at least. And if he had his locator beacon on, they would have found him because they deployed so rapidly. And apparently that's the end of the story. There's no conspiracy here. You know, anyone that describes this as him being taken by aliens is a complete crank, and then we just have to move on. No. And I don't see that being the case here at all. There are other people involved in this that suggest that something very, very different has happened.
Do we know what he was actually trying to intercept?
Yes. An unidentified flying object, allegedly, according to, unfortunately, two anonymous sources. But these sources have been connected with a man by the name of Otto and, of course, Tony Dodd, the famed UFO researcher. And Tony Dodd, in fact, I will link to his book, Alien Investigator, in the show notes so you can check it out. Tony Dodd, though, is seemingly a man of good reputation in the UFO field. And it just so happens that back in the early, I think it was the early 2000s, 2002, there was a British current affairs program, you know, 60 Minute style program called Inside Out. And they actually spoke to the sons, who are now grown, about, you know, what had happened. And because there's a lot of family trauma associated with this because their father just disappeared, they refuse to believe that it's got anything to do with UFOs at all. But listen to what Tony Dodd believes. Tony Dodd believes that there's something else going on here.
Where the pilot went to is the $64,000 question. Nobody has ever answered that to this day, and they've always admitted this it was quite bizarre.
Retired North Yorkshire policeman Tony Dodd believes Captain Shaffnett's target that night was an alien spacecraft.
Whether we will ever find the truth, I doubt, because the ministry will never release details which would confirm that a UFO abducted anybody. They will never accept that.
Well, that's not true. On the website I was looking at, it says that, number one, he was not tracking a UFO. So there you go.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, so that's
the FOIA request confirmed he wasn't chasing a UFO. That's the very first thing it says as well. It's a little bit conspicuous. Let's just get this out of the way. This was not a UFO.
It's definitely not a UFO. And by the way, this is really important to point out, the aircraft smashed into the ocean at 100, at least 180 miles per hour.
Maybe survivable.
Highly unlikely. It is highly unlikely that you would survive smashing into the ocean at 180 miles per hour and be able to, you know, as I was saying before, with the ejection, even with an ejection seat, it'd take you 30 seconds to get out. And yet somehow he was able to survive a smash into the ocean, into the dark night, and be able to climb out and then reclose the canopy. It's just, it's very, very strange. So unofficial reports, and this is what adds to the controversial nature of this stuff, is that actually on September the 8th in 1970, at Saxa-Vord, which is a radar station based in the Shetland Islands, and their primary function is to spot unidentified craft approaching the North Sea. It's the Cold War, makes total sense. Apparently on this particular night, the radar operators detected an unidentified aircraft halfway between the Shetland Islands and Norway. The object was tracked at moving at around 630 miles per hour. It was just below 40,000 feet. It was moving in a southwest trajectory, and then it started moving back towards the sea, back towards the seaside. It accelerated to Mach 1.2, which is about 980 miles per hour, and the RAF scrambled. They scrambled a whole heap of aircraft, and within several minutes, two Lightning interceptors were homing in on the object. And of course, they were expecting it to be a Russian jet or a Soviet jet, until they astound radio operators by saying that it wasn't that at all. And in fact, this unidentified flying craft was able to move in ways that no expected Russian plane would. It could turn 180 degrees on a dime, and it disappeared to the North Sea at a speed calculated at being 17,000 miles per hour. This is an incredible speed. And now we know about the Tic Tac stuff and, you know, the military being harassed and almost mocked by these unidentified flying aircraft. Is it not possible that that's exactly what's been occurring here? So the chase was joined by two F-4 Phantoms that were scrambled from United States Air Force Base in Ireland. The radar allegedly on board the Phantoms was extremely sophisticated and able to detect the object. They attempted to give it chase, but it just kept on disappearing at high speed. This thing, whatever it was playing a game of cat and mouse. And so NORAD got involved. They informed the Pentagon, and Bill Schaffner, who was currently on secondment at RAF Binbrook, was deployed. The Schaffner was considered to be an experienced and capable pilot. He was a Vietnam veteran. And according to the sources connected to Tony Dodd and others, a request was made by a high-level source to deploy him to get airborne and chase the mystery object. So they did. Like, he apparently was deployed. He came up there, and there is a transcript of a conversation that Schaffner and the radar station at Saxon Wold had that was reported in the Grimsby Evening Telegraph on October the 10th in 1992. So this is something that came out much later. This is something that I have not been able to verify because it came from an anonymous source connected to Otto and Tony Dodd.
Is this during the exercise?
This is during the alleged exercise. It's during the scramble. Essentially, Schaffner said something along the lines of, "I have visual contact, repeat visual contact." He's asked to identify the aircraft, and because this is a back and forth transcript, I'm not going to tell you the exact details. You can, you know, it gets quite boring. But essentially, he says, "No, it's nothing that's recognizable, but it's got these bluish lights. They're very bright, extremely bright." And he says, "It's a conical shape. It's bright. It's hurting my eyes to look at it for more than a few seconds." And then later on, and this is moments, when I say later on, moments later, he says, "There's something else. Wait. He's at my 3 o'clock. And there's a soccer ball. It's made of glass. It's separate from the main body. It's at the back. It's got a sharp end on the shape, and it's bobbing up and down, going from side to side slowly." And there were questions as to whether or not there was occupants, and he says, "No, nothing." And they ask more questions about this ball object. They say, this is Saxton, "Is the ball object still with it? Over." And his response is, "It's not actually connected. It may be some type of magnetic attraction to the conical shape. There's this haze of light." And then nothing.
It's funny, over at the aviation safety website where they detail this case, they have mention of his radio contact as well. And they say that he was ordered to accelerate to catch up with the lights. But when he was in radio contact again, he said suddenly he has to slow down because he was going to overtake them. So the suggestion was that this craft perhaps stopped much faster than he was able to anticipate.
Yep.
And when it says that when he was back in contact over the radio, he was under heavy strain, which suggested that he was suffering from severe G-forces.
Yes.
Perhaps trying to stop because this thing stopped on a dime. He was trying to slow and do some really unsafe turn or something.
Yeah, it's already displayed that to the other pilots, that this thing can just move around basically in any aerodynamic fashion that it prefers. And that's part of the official report, though, as well, that apparently when he was chasing this target, this bogey that was, and this is part of the exercise, the fake Soviets, is that because he was so inexperienced, he slowed down too much in this aircraft. And because he slowed down so much, that's why he crashed. But it's like, come on, you really expect us to believe that they're going to be running an exercise at night with a captain or a pilot that's on secondment and an aircraft that he's only had 18 hours of training in?
Yeah, I mean, they say that he was inexperienced and he only did 18 hours. But it also says here at this source that the reason he was given like operation readiness is because of his performance in the aircraft. Like he was a top gun.
Sure.
He was incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you tie it in with all the other pieces of evidence, it really does make you suspect that there's something else going on here. Now, let's add to some of the strangeness, right?
Was he abducted to planet Gok?
Well, we don't know.
For a giant sex orgy?
We don't know what happened there. But what we do know, apparently, is a few things. So one is that when the BBC in 2002 tried to look into this, they contacted the Ministry of Defence. And guess what the Ministry of Defence said? They said that the document, the report, was shredded. Like the report into his crash was shredded.
What does that mean?
And was no longer available.
Why was it shredded?
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. Like, why would it be shredded, right? Why would that happen? So the BBC starts poking around, and obviously they got the attention of someone because during their investigation, this happened.
Then a breakthrough. In the Morning Post, we receive a scribbled accident report from 1970. Schaffner, it says, had been on an exercise intercepting a slow-moving Shackleton reconnaissance plane. Its crew had lost radio contact. Then, by the light of a flare, they'd seen the lightning in the water. Schaffner, who'd had limited training, had simply flown too low trying to get beneath his target and hit the sea.
Yeah, that's the official explanation, right?
Yeah, exactly. But this is the thing. The BBC starts poking around. They're told that the document had been shredded, that the report was gone. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere in the Post, they received this hand-scribbled report, which is now the official story
of
what took place. Do you see what I'm saying?
It's like, let's give them some document.
Okay.
Let's make a document for them.
This is the next thing that happened. So the wreckage of the aircraft was recovered a month later, as we know, from the seabed. His body was never recovered. But it is normal practice to take the wreckage of any downed craft to the Ministry of Defence's crash investigation branch in Farnborough. But this was not the case. The aircraft was returned to Binbrook. It was kept out of sight by a series of shutters in the far corner of the hangar. Now, normally press photographers are allowed to go in and photograph the wreckage of downed craft. This was a standard practice that had been done. And of course, there were regular crashes, so they were used to this. But his wreckage was placed behind maximum security, and photographers were never permitted to go anywhere near it.
The aircraft wasn't secret or classified. But
nope.
But I guess it still makes sense, though, that if you've got military technology, you don't want just anyone coming and taking photos of it. I mean,
sure.
You don't want the Soviets copying the design.
That's all a possibility. But according to insiders and anonymous reports that were connected through Tony Dodd, they deliberately took this aircraft apart, took it into pieces, and scattered the pieces into different locations. Now, air crash investigators also arrived from Farnborough, and they said they were surprised. This is the unofficial report. They were surprised to find that some of the aircraft's instrumentation had been removed, including the compass, voltmeter, directional indicator, and complete auxiliary warning panel from the starboard side of the cockpit. Now, this aircraft seemingly was perfectly intact and landed intact on the sea floor after smashing in at 180 miles per hour. And yet these particular items were removed from the interior of the aircraft, but there was no external damage. Why?
Yeah, it's all a bit strange, isn't it?
Isn't it strange? It's really, really odd. Now, this is the next thing, okay? During the examination by the air crash investigators, they noted that there was an unusual smell within the cockpit, and the aircraft had an unusual slimy film across it.
What's the source on that?
This is the same source. This is coming from The Truth Hides, which is connected to Tony Dodd and Otto.
Wow.
Throughout their very brief time with the aircraft, apparently these investigators from the RAF were supervised by five unnamed civilians, two of whom were Americans. The following day, the investigators were rounded up and informed that under no circumstances were they to discuss anything to do with the crashed aircraft, and the reason quoted was because of national security. So yes, it's the Cold War, and
it's not surprising that Americans are involved, obviously, but with civilians?
Yeah. So, well, when they say civilians, is it CIA? NSA? Is it one of these other hidden intelligence agencies that we don't know much about?
Did they want to get a sample of the slime?
Yeah. What is this? So was the guy abducted by aliens? Is that what happened to him? He was seemingly pursuing a UFO. The Ministry of Defence denies it. His sons deny it. In fact, in that documentary or in that BBC audio there, I'll link to the full episode in the show notes. But his son gets really quite emotionally distressed. He's like, my father wasn't chasing UFOs. I'm like, dude, I am sorry for your loss, but how the hell do you know?
Yeah.
You were a kid and you're just going to be, you're going to believe what you're being told. And the fact that you're being given, you know, information like, well, the report was shredded, and yet all of a sudden it shows up later on only after the media starts, you know, sticking their noses into it. It suggests to me that there's something else going on here.
I just wonder why they would need to have the file under lock and key for 90 years.
Yeah.
It just seems excessive. Well, is that a standard thing for files during that time period?
Nicole, in his work, says that apparently because of this error, it wasn't just the fact that he took off so quickly and didn't get it serviced. This was like not a design fault, but essentially it was a fault in many aircraft. And they very rapidly upgraded the aircrafts to fix this error afterwards. But I'm like, really? You're going to cover up the disappearance of a pilot over a screw? Like, is that some type of significant military embarrassment? I don't think so. Or in a government embarrassment? I mean, even if it does come down to money and being sued, I don't know. Does the government really care that much? It just suggests to me, with all the murkiness of this, that there's something else going on here. Look, and I'm not saying that it's aliens. It is odd, however, that they are pursuing some type of unidentified craft and this takes place. I mean, how do we not know that, you know, it's not aliens? It could have been the Soviets, you know, testing experimental aircraft, and they somehow took him and, you know, took all the instruments as well. I don't know. But there are other stories that start popping up from the UK around this time. And that's where I have to bring us to the Mull Air mystery. And this is where it becomes even more unusual. This gets a missing 411 twist in this particular case. So 1975, we head to the Isle of Mull off the west coast of Scotland. And this case has everything in it for a classic mystery, but it's not well known outside the UK. It relates to a Peter Gibbs who went missing in his light aircraft on Christmas Eve in 1975. It has been reported as being this simple case of misadventure, but there's all of these strange elements because rescue efforts failed to find any trace of this missing pilot or his aircraft. Although something strange happened 4 months later. His body was found and the circumstances of his death seem to be extremely baffling. So essentially what happened with this story is that Gibbs had, he was around 44, I believe, and he had gone to Glenforza. So Glenforza is actually this little hotel building that has a daytime runway next to it. And the reason why I say it's a daytime runway, because it doesn't have any, you know, guiding instruments, there's no lighting, anything like that. So it's a very dangerous place to land and take off, you know, in difficult conditions. But essentially there was this little hotel that had been built there. It burnt down in 1968, I believe. And then in 1969, just the year later, it was replaced by the Scandinavian style wooden building. And he had decided that he'd have a change in his career and what he was doing and thought that he would actually go and purchase property in this area. So he goes to Glenforza with his 32-year-old girlfriend, who was a university lecturer or former university lecturer. Her name was Felicity Granger. And when they get to this particular island, or this particular location, they were going to celebrate his birthday. So they get there. His birthday is the 25th of December, but they get there on the 24th. They arrive in this Cessna F-150H. And it's a standard light aircraft. It's equipped with parachutes. Nothing particularly, you know, stands out or special about it. But he's a gifted musician, a talented violin player, really a man that apparently was quoted as being, I shouldn't say arrogant, but quite comfortable with who he is. Now, on the 24th of December, around 9 p.m. when he's checked into this chalet, he abruptly announces just out of nowhere that he's going to take his Cessna for a short flight. And he retires and he goes and changes into his flying gear and he walks out. Now, when he walks into the bar, hotel staff are like, no, like this runway is not designed for that. It's completely dark. There's no moon. And a storm is brewing. A storm is expected within an hour. And he's like, don't worry about it. I've got a couple of torches. And I'm not kidding. He gets his girlfriend. He gives her two torches and they take them out and use them as improvised runway lights.
Wow.
So she climbs out of the aircraft because she's not going to fly with him. But she's like, why do you need to do this? He's like, I'm just going to go up 5 minutes. I'm just going to go and fly around for 5 minutes so that I can just kind of check out the area and see where we might want to buy property and real estate. And she's like, okay, that's fine. She puts the two torches down. He flies away. And he's fine, right? He seemingly is okay, but he said he was only going to be gone for a few minutes. Now, after taking off, the wind starts rising, clouds begin, you know, brewing on the horizon, and the weather gets worse and worse and worse. Now, she runs back into the hotel and reports to the hotel staff that Gibbs has failed to return. The hotel staff immediately call police, and while they're waiting, they're driving around trying to see if they can see any lights on the water. Perhaps he's crashed. Maybe he hasn't been able to get back to this runway 26 that it was called. They were checking their radio because he did have a radio to see. There's nothing. Now, the next day, this huge air sea operation began. But guess what happens? The entire area is hampered by a severe thunderstorm that lasts 72 hours. What do we know about this? This is missing 411. People disappear. And when a search operation is conducted, sometimes it's impeded by terrible weather.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what happens. The police mountain rescue unit from the local town come and search the hills. They search the Loch of Mull. Local shepherds and forestry workers are looking out for any signs of wreckage. Nothing. Nothing's found. And they search for 2 weeks. They call it off because they just assume that Gibbs had crashed into the sea. 4 months later, on the 21st of April in 1976, a local shepherd by the name of Donald McKinnon makes this startling discovery 400 feet up a small hill that's looking over the Sound of Mull. It's less than a mile from the airstrip where Gibbs had taken off. Lying on his back across a larch log was Gibbs. He's dead. Like, obviously, he's dead. But he's wearing his flying clothes, his boots. But the body is taken for forensic examination, and it's confirmed that indeed it's him. But his body is in a very good condition. He's been missing for 4 months. You know, locals are saying, well, first of all, you would have the entomology that would take place where almost immediately the body would start to be infested with insects and start to break down. Nope, that hadn't happened. All they found is that he had a superficial cut on his right leg, but no other injuries.
What the hell?
Nothing that was consistent with a person who had been involved in an air crash. Oh, and by the way, where's his aircraft? Where's his aircraft? They don't find any identifiable cause of death. They don't know how this guy died. And so if he had fallen out of his aircraft, wouldn't he have suffered crush injuries?
Yes,
you know, he'd be mashed. He didn't die from exposure.
So it's like he's been taken somewhere, disappeared for four months, and then placed for rescuers to find.
Now,
very missing 411.
Absolutely it is. They check his clothing and his boots. There's no indication that he was immersed in salt water. Nothing. Now, Donald McKinnon, who was the shepherd who had discovered the body, he was adamant that he and his dogs had actually passed that spot, again, missing 411, multiple times after Gibbs' disappearance, but he had not been there. Multiple times in that four months. Why was his body largely intact when found? And even the locals had said, look, with the Scottish Hills, if you leave any type of carcass out there, the carcass will be taken apart by predators and, you know, you'd have exposure. None of that was there. So other stories started coming out though. Other people were reporting that the night that he took off, there was a person by the name of Howard. It was David and Pauline Howard who had watched Gibbs maneuvering the aircraft prior to taking off on December the 24th. They had seen what they thought were two torches being moved separately at the end of the runway. They thought that it was the presence of a third person. But Granger, the girlfriend, had insisted that no, she was the only person with two torches. So why were there other odd lights at the end of the runway that no one else had seen, but they are insistent that they had? Why was the weather in the way? Obviously it could just be normal weather, but in missing 411 cases, it's always the weather is extremely strange.
And what, they never recovered the aircraft?
So they think that they may have seen the aircraft. There was a professional diver by the name of George Foster in September of 1986. He was searching for scallops in the Sound of Mull. And he reported discovering wreckage of an aircraft about 100 feet deep, 500 meters away from the shoreline near that runway. And he examined it and he saw that the wings had been torn from the aircraft, but the cockpit doors were closed and the windscreen destroyed. So some of the theories, you know, the more non-alien-esque or missing 411 theories is that somehow he had managed to dive out of the aircraft, maybe through the windshield, and had swum back to shore and then had died of exposure. It doesn't make sense, though, because the autopsy was unable to confirm that. And like we know from the shepherd, McKinnon, that he'd wandered past that site many times. So it's not like the guy had just hung around for 4 months. There has to be another explanation. But the explanation
is... He was on planet Gok getting obliterated, and then they dumped his used body.
Well, look, after George Foster, this scallop diver, you know, came up to the surface and tried to find it, he could never find it again. Like, they weren't able to confirm. In April of 2004, there was a Royal Navy minesweeper. In fact, there were three of them that were operating in the Sound. They were testing equipment, locating mines, and they pinged something on the seabed floor, which happened to be in the same location where, you know, Foster had discovered the aircraft. But underwater cameras deployed, they found something. It turns out that it was a RAF Catalina flying boat that was lost in 1945.
Oh, okay.
So that wasn't it. So there's many theories as to what occurred here. I don't know what's going on here. I only know when you look at other stories, and particularly things like Missing 411, but even the Valentich case, it suggests that there's some type of non-human interference that's occurring here. It may be a natural phenomenon. It may be an extraterrestrial species. It could be interdimensional interlopers. I don't know. But none of this makes sense when you look at it from... You try to be rational about this. You just... Whenever you get the official explanation, you still can't find answers.
Like, sometimes you just got to exercise the Bermuda Triangle. Maybe it's ghosts. Let's be rational. Maybe it's ghosts.
I'm not going to go that far, right? But what I think it could be...
But it might be aliens.
It could,
not,
no, no, no.
We don't want to go that far.
What I'm going to say is I wonder, though, if this is some type of natural phenomena, maybe a weather phenomena, a magnetic anomaly, something along those lines. I'm not entirely sure, but, you know, where I head is actually some of the research that we've heard from people like Jenny Randles. Jenny Randles, of course, published the fantastic book Time Storms, Amazing Evidence for Time Warps, Space Rifts, and Time Travel. And, you know, when you look at some of the cases that she's published, it just so happens that there seemingly are many cases of people that are propelled through time, the ones that actually survive, the ones that actually come back and describe their experiences. They often describe being enveloped in some type of weird, intelligent light, a light that is moving around them. Sometimes it's described as being a light that clings to them. Mm. In other circumstances, they say there's an intelligence to it. And when it grabs hold of them, they find that they can be propelled not just many meters. In some circumstances, they can be propelled hundreds of miles into locations where they've never been before in the blink of an eye. They're also known as time blinks. This is one description that's been described for them. But there is this one case that I want to start off with that's from the Isle of Mull. Like, it's right from this particular area where this strange time distortion took place. So take a listen to this, Ben. There was a woman by the name of Dawn. This was on the Isle of Mull in 1887, so obviously a little bit later, but still around the same time frame of what had happened. She was touring through Scotland, and they'd headed down to the Isle of Mull. And when she was there, she met up with a Dwight and Geraldine. These were American colleagues of hers, and they'd driven their car off the ferry and had, you know, been driving for a couple of hours through the island's main town. They were enjoying this, you know, really beautiful scenery because apparently it's a spectacular location. But Dawn said that there was something odd. There was like a feeling. And as they're driving along, out of nowhere, this mist appears and attaches itself to the car. Now, she's like, what the hell? They all duck down inside the vehicle. And as they duck down, they start feeling this heavy pressure pushing down on them and this vibrating sensation that makes the car, like the entire car, feel like it's moving sideways and upways. The fog becomes so thick that it completely blocks their entire view and they end up in some type of blackness. Now, in it, as they're trying to look out the window, they describe this vortex surrounding them. Dawn's screaming, but no one else in the car can hear them, and the mist just simply disappears and dissipates. Now, this is a shocking experience. They have no understanding of what's just taken place. They're all checking each other and like, oh, okay, it's fine. It just so happens that it is in the vicinity of where this other aircraft had disappeared. It's apparently a natural phenomenon. But guess what happened? While all this activity was taking place and they're being pushed around in the car and there's mist everywhere and strange noises, they look at the back of their vehicle. Someone has opened the locked trunk, gone through all their stuff and just strewn it about on the road and then disappeared.
So did they take anything?
No, nothing was taken. But it reminds me of like, well, you know, that earlier report where the instruments were taken from the aircraft. We don't know what happened with the aircraft in the second report. But it seems like there's an intelligence to this kind of stuff that's going on. And there's a whole heap of these kinds of cases. So it starts back, You know, in the 1880s, for example, there's reports of this stuff happening in China. On the 8th of May in 1880, there was a farmer by the name of Zhu Tan. He claims that he sees this misty light hovering about in the bushes. And he's like, oh, that's kind of odd. He approaches this thing. And as he approaches, he says he finds himself floating upwards and he kind of blanks out. And with many of these reports, like what I said there with Dawn, there's this like a rushing sound that happens. It seems to incapacitate people. It causes some type of neurological disturbance, sometimes a paralysis. But he claims that when he came to, he was 300 miles away and it was 2 weeks later. This guy, he is insistent. I know it's the 1880s, but he is insistent in the report that he had been sucked up into the sky in the blink of an eye, had been teleported 300 miles and 2 weeks through time.
Well, we just did this case. We just did this case.
Was that the one?
Episode. No, no, no. This is the same. When I say we did this case, I mean we did the same phenomenon on a recent PLOS episode. What was that episode? That was the case of Huang Yanchu.
But didn't he have an entity that was taking him place?
No, but he didn't know that. I mean, his first situation was exactly what you described. He went to sleep and then woke up in another city 300 miles away and has no idea how he got there.
Oh, yeah, that's actually a good point. So, yeah, around the same time. But this is demonstrating that this is a global phenomenon, right? This is not just something that happens, you know, in a localized kind of location. And that's what much of Jenny Randall's work in this particular book focuses on, that this is something that's been happening throughout time all across the globe. And while it might not be the umbrella answer, it may not answer every single strange disappearance. When you look at these stories, there's a whole heap of people that seemingly are teleported through time or teleported to different locations through some type of natural anomaly. What about the people that never come back? Like, that's the question. Are there people that go somewhere else? And in fact, it seems like there is. There was one particular report here that I was looking at. It happened in Somerset. This is also in the UK in the 28th of July in 1974. It relates to the Williamsons. So the Williamsons, Peter was the husband. He apparently saw this huge flash, like out of nowhere. There was this huge flash that took place and he was disoriented and he vanished. He vanished for 3 days. The town was searched. There were people out looking for him. Obviously, people were really worried about him. And guess what happens? He reappears standing halfway in a pond. Now, he's got 1 foot on the shore or 1 foot on the edge.
Is he alive?
He's alive. He's standing up. He's disoriented. To him, it's only been moments, right, that's passed after this flash. Now, he's taken to hospital and he's incoherent. And the guy is completely incoherent. And finally, he recovers his senses and he kind of comes back. And he describes the most unusual and strange thing. He says, I can recall the names of the doctors. And they're like, who are you talking? He's saying the doctors, the nurses. He's describing the details of these people and the hospital he was taken to. And say, you weren't taken to any hospital. You've been missing for 3 days. And finally, when he becomes completely coherent, he says that he seemingly ended up in a parallel reality. There was a flash. He came to. When he came to, people rushed around him, didn't know. Like, he found himself standing in a road that he was unfamiliar with. He was taken to a hospital in this alternative reality. And he said when he was in this hospital, he said the walls shimmered. It's like there'd be a sudden shift. And it was like he wasn't supposed to be in that reality. It was like he wasn't being maintained in it. And all of a sudden, he closed his eyes. The hospital shimmered around him. And bam, he finds himself standing in a pond.
Did you see the article from Brent on our site? I think it was last week. It was on this Englishman who moved to Canada in the 1800s, around the same time, 1874. His name was Sir Cecil Edward Denny. He joined Canada's Northwest Mounted Police. He wrote this kind of memoir of his time in this area called The Riders of the Plains. But in it, he details this strange storm that came through one day, and he describes that same flash that you're describing. This
interesting,
like, not he called it liquid lightning.
Yeah, because this is what people describe. Many people that have this particular type of encounter, they say that there's like a liquid feel to it, and it clings to things. Like, it envelops and it clings to things.
Yeah, he said it looked like it was alive, and he's encased by this strange liquid light. And when that was over, he looks in front of him, and where there was nothing before, there's now an entire settlement of Indians.
Interesting.
You know, like young kids running around and, you know, hunters and just heaps of them. And then there was another, he observed them for like 10 minutes, wondering what the hell was going on. And then there was another kind of flash. and then it was all gone again. And when he asked others what they had seen, they just laughed at him and thought he was crazy.
Yeah, of course, and that's the thing. But I think that actually goes to my point, is that, you know, the stories that I'm relating to you that, you know, have been described by Jenny Randles and others, you know, there's a multitude of people that have described these sorts of strange time distortions. These are the people that have come back. So is it that people are being taken? Like, when he was pursuing, like, we go back to the original case with Schaffner, he's pursuing this ball of light. Was he actually pursuing a UFO? Was he pursuing a natural phenomenon? And he encountered it and he went somewhere else. He went to another dimension. He went to another reality, and there's no way for him to come back. You know, Gibbs that disappeared off the Isle of Mull, did he encounter something like this? And we know from the story of Dawn that there are other reports around the same time. So I find these particular cases to be fascinating. And it's like there's so much controversy, particularly around the Schaffner case, where I'm like, I think the government knows something. I don't think they're being honest. I just do not believe that they're being honest and they would do a cover-up, though, over a screw. But is it that the government, it's not even about aliens. Is it the government knows about natural phenomena and they can't control it, so they can't warn people about it in this region? So they're trying
to keep
it quiet.
Are they in on it? Are all these people being kidnapped to Planet Gok?
Well, is it Big Cloud? You know, is there something going on with the store? I don't know. I don't know what this is. But look, there are other cases. Let me describe this case for you. Where is this? So this was Oxford in the United States, 1975, David and Marie Stevens, 3 a.m. They're driving along. As they're driving along, their car is suddenly engulfed in a coloured glow. Like, this glow comes from nowhere. They've got confusion for hours after this particular incident, but they're instantly relocated. They find themselves a mile away. And as they get out of their vehicle, there's still this grey fog clinging to their car before it finally dissipates. You're going to describe the weirdness surrounding the Bermuda Triangle, Ben. You know, there's two people that we know quite well. There's the story of Bruce Gernon, who was flying from Palm Beach in 1970. He claims that he encountered a light tunnel with rotating walls as they flew through this tunnel. I think it was that the tips of their wings was like scraping the side of this tunnel, this weird vortex. They described, well, Gernon described in their experience with the two of them, that there was some type of zero gravity effect that was taking place while they were inside this tunnel. It was only because they had their seatbelts on that they didn't, you know, come flying out of their seats. But as they came out of the tunnel, there was a green mist clinging to the aircraft. You know, lots of stories that are like this. Then you have another great case, though, of where it's like some type of, this is the intelligence that appears to be behind this, because many of these stories seem to be very much random. Like, there's really nothing to it. I mean, there was Brazil 1981, a man by the name of George Ramos. He went missing. His car was found with the keys in the ignition. No one knows what had happened to him. They went searching for him. They actually assumed that maybe it was a robbery. There was some type, it was a rough crime area. You know, perhaps he'd been kidnapped. There was a lot of fear. No one knows what happened to him until 5 days later, his wife gets a telephone call from him. He's 600 miles away. He's 600 miles away. And you know,
how?
He says that he was driving along the road. A white glow appeared above him, enveloped the car, and then took him. And then he woke up 600 miles away 5 days later, not knowing, you know, what had happened to him. For him, it was just a blink. Another case from Brazil, 1973, 3 a.m. Again, there was a man by the name of Onislo Patero. A blue glow swallowed his car. His body felt extremely hot. I think super hot is the term that he used. He noticed that a vortex was spinning around his car. As the vortex was spinning around his car, he said the molecular structure of the car caused it to become transparent.
What?
It was transparent. What are these things? You know, is it just some type of physics that we don't understand? Or is there something more to it? And then, of course, you've got sad cases. This is very unusual. This relates to a man by the name of Keith Field. This happened in Camberwell in the UK in 1963. And this kid, when Keith was a kid, he'd found a box of fireworks with his friends. It was like Firefox Night or something like that. And they're all excited about these fireworks. There's a fog that had come in and they were lighting these fireworks on the road or just off the side of the road. And Keith had wandered onto the road and this car just comes out of nowhere. Like, just out of nowhere, this car starts to appear. And Keith insists that time starts to slow down because it's a certainty. There's just, he's going to be killed. He's going to be at least run down by this car, this speeding car. He says everything starts to immediately slow down. There's that classic Jenny Randall's Oz factor that kicks in where everything goes silent. He can't hear any screeching. He can hear initially like the screams of his friends and onlookers, but then that all disappears. And he says a blue glow seemingly envelops the car. A fuzzy blue glow envelops the car. Now, the moment the car is completely taken over, he comes to and all the sound comes rushing back in. It's like this vacuum gets reversed and the sound comes pouring back in like a siphon or something, and as the sound rushes. And the car's on the other side of him, but it's on the other side. So it's like the car was either teleported or he was somehow, I don't know. I don't know what this blue glow is. Is it moving the car? Is it moving him? Is it making him transparent or able to pass through metal and organic material? The strange thing is that the driver was found dead of a heart attack.
Oh, bizarre.
So it's like the effect, and because there is plenty of reports of the physiological effects of these strange clouds, these strange lights that do things. And there was another great
case. What, the driver died so he could live?
Well, no, I don't even think it's that exotic. I think it's just that, I don't know. Obviously, it suggests there's some type of intelligent control there, but maybe it's just a side effect. Like, I don't think it killed him. I mean, maybe it is more like a...
Maybe the driver saw what happened and it was so...
Yeah,
shocking.
Possibly. Yeah, possibly that occurred. But then there's a more positive case. This comes from Rodney in the United States in 1968 in Michigan. There was a woman by the name of Sharon Cooper. She'd just put her young toddler son down to bed for the evening, and she'd gone out the front. And when she was at the front, I think she was talking to a neighbor or something like that, and this car just comes screeching down the road, like screeching down the road, and it's out of control. It's speeding. And she's just, you know, she's not, she's obviously concerned, but she's not distressed. It's like, what's this idiot doing? Is it a drunk driver? You know, what's happening? She sees this white mist suddenly appear and envelop the car. It takes the car, and the car just goes, the car's gone, right? She's shocked. She starts screaming because she looks up. She realizes her toddler son, who she's just put down to sleep, had gotten out of bed and had wandered out onto the road. The light had saved the kid by dematerializing the car. Now, of course, you know, we don't have any way to validate these stories, but it fits in with a larger pattern from, you know, a multitude of witnesses that have said they've encountered these things. And it's typical. There's this engulfment that occurs. There's some type of transport that seems to happen, whether it's through space or time. And there's many of them. There's a whole heap of these reports that have been around for a long time. So look, I'll link to all of these reports in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org. I'll link to the story about Schaffner. I'll leave it up to you to, you know, decide what you think happened to Schaffner. I don't think it's Planet Gok.
No, but we just don't rule it out.
I'm not going to rule it out.
The records are unsealed in 90 years' time, in 2090 or whatever
it
is.
Again, like, even if you rule out, you say, look, if you've got complete skepticism and you say that's absurd, the idea that it's time warps or aliens or any type of supernatural phenomena, clearly it's just that, you know, the government was embarrassed. But why were they covered up for so long?
I'm not sure about that date, though, because I did a search on the National Archives for a bunch of other stuff. Like, I just did a standard UFO search and I just clicked around on various things. And most of the documents aren't open until the 2080s. So it might just be a standard stamp.
Could be. Maybe.
Just, I mean, think of all the files you deal with in the National Archives and, you know, military files, classified files. It would make sense for them to go, just for safety, let's just, you know, stamp it at 60 years
maybe.
For every single thing that comes in.
But the thing is, this particular case has attracted so much attention. You would think that, you know, UFO investigators and a multitude of people, journalists that are trying to get these details, that they would push it through, that they would, like, why would you keep it under wraps for so long? It just doesn't make sense to me. And, you know, like I said, we can't trust governments. So I don't know what's going on with this case, but I certainly think we're not being told the truth. But I'll leave that up to you to make your own decision. I'll link to all of it in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org. But for Plus members, we're going to head back into the Bermuda Triangle, Ben.
More coming up on this show. We're going to be looking at Gabriel Amorth, the infamous late exorcist for the Vatican, and some of the things he wrote about in terms of explaining the demonic. He was very wary of ethnic statues. He had this whole section. It's like very obscure.
You mean like voodoo or?
Yeah, just like African masks and things like that. He's like, anything ethnic, just like, I would never have it in my home.
Why? Was he worried about some kind of...
Because they're all cursed by evil entities. It's like, get rid of those Bali flags. Cursed by demons. And of course, yeah, he mentions this idea of ancestral curses.
Yes. Yeah, I like that. Well, I don't like the idea, but I'm fascinated by that concept.
And it's through that we lead to Kenneth McCall, who, again, as I mentioned, missionary, spent much of his young years in China adventuring, battling the Japanese and the communists and the nationalists, managing to survive. And when he came back to England, he started to get into psychiatry and get into mental illness work. And he was convinced that some tribulations that people have in their lives, some mental illnesses, some, I guess, afflictions stem from not something that you've done, but something that your ancestor has done.
I'm screwed then.
Yeah. Well, in some of the cases I'll be covering after the break, they're traced back, they trace them back through the family tree, and it goes back to like some ancestor in the 1750s who did something horrible, and you're paying the price for it, according to Kenneth McCall. So we'll be looking at that after the break. If you want to get access, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. We've got big extensions on these shows every single Friday. You're getting more than an extra hour usually on these shows we do. And also, Plus members get an exclusive episode. There's a season running concurrently that comes out every Tuesday as well. You're getting more than double the content if you sign up for Plus. You also get a higher quality version of the show in terms of the audio and a totally ad-free version of the show as well. And of course, if you sign up for the MU Max tier, you get access to our massive, massive back catalogue of shows going back a decade plus. Again, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. Help support your favourite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Plus extension, great to have you with us.